A color photograph of the three Apollo 11 astronauts is available in limited supply for our VOA listeners. We will send you one if you write to The Voice of America, Washington, D.C., USA, Box 8108. Citizens of the United States are not eligible.
This is The Voice of America. We will return to our live coverage of the mission of Apollo 11 following this report of late world news in special English.
In the headlines, the Apollo astronauts get ready to leave the moon. They will join the waiting command ship for return to Earth. World leaders praise the historic flight. Now the news in detail. The moon. Apollo 11 astronauts Armstrong and Aldrin will fire the rocket of their moon ship less than 1 hour from now. The rocket will lift them from the moon's surface and push them into orbit, where astronaut Collins is waiting in the Apollo command ship. The blastoff will end the first visit to the moon by men of Earth. The two astronauts landed their lunar module yesterday, then, a few hours later, left the ship to step onto the moon. Neil Armstrong took the first step, and as he did, he told millions of persons listening on radio and television, "That's one small step for man, one giant step for all mankind." Astronaut Aldrin joined him a few minutes later. They walked and jumped to show that humans can move on the moon with less difficulty than expected. Because of weak gravity, the astronauts weighed only 1/6 as much on the moon as they do on Earth. A television camera broadcast continuous pictures of the astronauts as they worked on the moon. They picked up rocks and moon soil to bring back to Earth. The two men also put several pieces of scientific equipment on the moon, and they took many pictures. While on the moon's surface, they received a telephone message from Mr. Nixon at the White House. The president told them that because of what they had done, the heavens have become part of man's world. A little more than 2 hours after they began the moonwalk, the two men climbed back into the lunar module to rest before leaving the moon. It is expected to take the lunar module about 3 hours to join with the command module, but space officials expect this to go as smoothly as have all other parts of the flight. As the Apollo 11 astronauts prepared to leave the moon, the Soviet Union's Luna 15 space machine was reported to have landed. The Jodrell Bank Observatory said it had received signals which seemed to show that Luna 15 had made a landing on the moon. It said the Soviet space machine is believed to have landed near the area known as the Sea of Crises. This would be about 800 kilometers from the Apollo 11 landing area in the Sea of Tranquility. Luna 15, which carries no men, has been circling the moon for 5 days. The Soviet Union has refused to give any details about the purpose of its flight. Hundreds of millions of people across the world are watching and listening to television and radio reports of Apollo 11. But in Communist China, North Korea, and North Vietnam, national broadcasts failed to report the moon landing. Moscow radio said millions of Soviet citizens saw the Apollo moon walk on a television program early today. It said the same program will be shown again later. The Soviet government, for the first time, told its people that the astronauts carried medals to the moon honoring two dead Soviet spacemen. Pope Paul, when he heard of the Apollo landing, said, "Glory to God in the highest, and on earth peace to men of goodwill." Patriarch Athenagoras of the Eastern Orthodox Church said the world perhaps will have a new understanding of God. Britain's Queen Elizabeth sent President Nixon a message praising the Apollo moon landing. Presidents and prime ministers of other nations added their praise and congratulations. French President Georges Pompidou said American science has made reality of one of man's greatest dreams. Japan's Prime Minister Isaku Sato said the Apollo 11 landing shows progress toward the beginning of a real space age for all mankind. India's Prime Minister Indira Gandhi said this is a moment of both triumph and humility. She urged that man's power be used in the struggle for brotherhood and peace. The Middle East. Egypt reports that Israeli artillery and rocket fire hit the city of Suez today. A Reuters news agency report from Cairo says a group of newsmen were prevented from visiting the city because of new exchanges of fire there. Israel, however, denies that its forces fired on the city of Suez. Yesterday, forces of both nations fought a six-hour ground and air battle across the canal. Egypt accused Israel of starting the trouble and said it will inform the UN Security Council of this. South Vietnam. Prime Minister Tran Van Hung has denied earlier reports that the South Vietnamese cabinet had resigned. An assistant to the Prime Minister said Mr. Hung met with his cabinet today and told the ministers that some cabinet changes were expected. He said the Prime Minister made no decision when some of the ministers proposed that the cabinet resign so that the changes would be easier to make. Kenya. Reuters news agency reports that police in Nairobi have arrested a man on charges of murdering Tom Mboya, Kenya's economic and planning minister. Mr. Mboya was shot to death about 2 weeks ago in Nairobi. The arrested man is reported to be Nahashan Isaac Njenga Njoroge. He was officially charged with the murder today. Police gave no further details, but said their investigation is continuing. Again, the headlines. Just a moment, we have a few more stories. Nigerian developments. Biafra says its forces have captured the town of Abiriba on the edge of Umahia. The former Biafran capital, Radio Biafra also said Nigerian forces have been forced out of the southern part of Umahia. Nigeria has not reported on the Biafran claim. America's former Vice President Hubert Humphrey has met with Soviet Prime Minister Alexei Kosygin. He said the Soviet leader told him that the Soviet Union wants to work with the United States for progress toward peace. Mr. Humphrey said he would offer a report on his talks to President Nixon and Secretary of State Rogers when he returns to Washington. Again, the headlines. The Apollo astronauts get ready to leave the moon. They will join the waiting command ship for return to Earth. World leaders praise the historic flight. That's the news in special English from the Voice of America newsroom, Jim Hamilton reporting.
This is the Voice of America's continuing coverage of the flight of Apollo 11. I'm Larry West in Washington. There have been thousands of men involved in the successful landing of Americans on the moon. One of those men is Lyndon Johnson, who very early chose to be an advocate of the space program and who devoted his influence as senator, vice president, and finally as president on our nation's space policy. 2 weeks ago, Columbia Broadcasting System newsman Walter Cronkite talked with the former president at his home in Johnson City, Texas. Mr. Johnson outlined what he considers the significance of the American space effort.
I think it was the beginning of the revolution of the 60s. I think that when we realized, after Sputnik 1 and 2, that we had been challenged successfully, and the Soviet Union had been able to do things that up till then we had failed to do and been unable to do, and our little 35-pound effort had blown up in our face. Our people are slow to start, but hard to stop. I think the people said, well, if you can go to the moon, if you can do this in space, why can't we do something about education in this country? Up to that time, the federal government hadn't passed any education bill. We didn't have any federal aid for education. We did a little in the field of vocational education. Outside of that, 185 years, we've done nothing. So we started passing education bills. We made a national effort, elementary education, a national effort in higher education, where 2 million students were brought into our colleges. And they said, well, if you do that for space and send a man to the moon, why can't we do something for grandma with Medicare? And so we passed the Medicare Act, and we passed 40 other measures in the health field. But when we got into the space effort and saw what technology could do, and saw what administrators that were competent could do with the taxpayers' dollar by spending $4 or $5 billion. Well, they started spending several billions on education and some on health and some on conservation. And when we did that, of course, there's a great deal of unrest in the country because the people felt, well, why hadn't we done this before? And the space program was the beginning, but it's not the end. Not the end in space, and not the end in all these other revolutionary developments that are coming. And there's not anything that's given this nation as much pride abroad, all the other nations, as our space program. Every place you go, one of the first things they'll tell you is what they think of our astronauts and what a fine job they have done. And the last thing I did before I left office was to write to 186 leaders of foreign governments and send them a picture taken by Apollo 8 of the Earth. And the response that I got to that letter and that picture is truly amazing. Even in May, after I'd returned here to the ranch and got my mail out of Johnson City, there came a letter from Ho Chi Minh.
From Ho Chi Minh?
Ho Chi Minh thanking me for sending him this picture and expressing his appreciation this act. I think the appreciation of our space effort is universal. We've truly used it for peaceful purposes. As a consequence, we've been able to negotiate two treaties with the Soviet Union. One that would provide for the safe return of spacemen wherever they might have to land, and the other one providing that we wouldn't use armament in space. And as a result, I think that if we've been able to negotiate these treaties, well, we have a chance to enter into other treaties that we should negotiate.
Some historians have suggested, Mr. President, that the Bay of Pigs, perhaps, can be given some credit for our man in space program, in the sense that we needed a moral victory after that considerable defeat, and that this might have been a motivating factor in President Kennedy's enunciating the Apollo program. Do you see a relation in these two things?
Well, I know that was charged. I never took the charge very seriously. I was concerned, and if you look through the volumes of the hearings that contained the evidence, the experts in this country, you'll see that most of the leaders in this field were concerned in 57, many years before the Bay of Pigs, more concerned in 58. And after we've finished our studies and made our recommendations, made a nonpartisan effort out of it, President Eisenhower accelerated the appropriation, stepped up the program. And by the time President Kennedy came in, President Kennedy could pick it up, expand it. He set it a goal and an objective, and he asked the Congress to join him in committing the country to that objective, and we succeeded. I don't think the Bay of Pigs had a thing in the world to do with it, except someone charged for political purposes that was the reason President Kennedy recommended the space program. And I never did see any connection.
How did this happen to be a civilian program when it seemed logically, certainly the Air Force thought it was logical, that it be an Air Force program?
I can't think of anything that had been more disastrous to the program as a whole and to our country in the light of the view of other nations. And if they had thought that we were occupying space to try to control the world and to place armaments in space and threaten the existence of the world. And although there were some recommendations, President Kennedy asked me one time about appointing a friend of his who was a general as the original administrator of the space program. He asked me to consider recommending General Gavin. And I said, Mr. President, I think that's the worst thing we could do for the program would be put a man with stars on his shoulder in a general's uniform in charge of the space effort of this country, because it would frighten the other nations and be a great disservice to our own program. As a result, I spent days and days interviewing 19 or 20 of the outstanding men in this country and asking them to take on this assignment. For one reason or other, they found out they couldn't do it. Some of them considered it, but didn't accept. Mr. Webb turned it down. Just said that he had commitments that wouldn't permit him to accept the assignment. Finally, I sent for him a second time, and I said, you have served your country in many different capacities, and you're familiar with the Congress, and the Congress respects you, both the House and Senate. And you cannot turn your country down when we call upon you now. And he said, all right, if you put it that way, I'll take it. I called President Kennedy on the telephone and said, I talked to Jim Webb. He's ready to take the job. He said, bring him down and we'll announce it. And in 10 minutes, we were in the president's office. And in 20 minutes, Mr. Webb's announcement, his appointment to head NASA, had been made. And I think that was a great day for all of us.
Do you think the speed with which we went for this goal of man on the moon might have been a little excessive? Would have been better if we'd spread our $24 billion out over 20 years instead of 10 and put some of that money into these other projects you mentioned?
I think we have enough money in this country to do all the things we need to do, and that includes space And that includes education, health, and these other things. What we must have in this country is the determination to do it. Now, that's what we had with space. We were just sailing along and letting the rest of the world go by, and oh, everybody was just as happy as they could be, and here came Sputnik 1. And it set up a warning signal, and they said, oh, what can we do about this? And while we were considering what we'd do, here's Sputnik 2. And we got the experts in, and they testified that we generally agreed that we ought to roll up our sleeves and get going, and we did. Now, that's what we need to do in this country about all these other problems we have. We can't discard space. We're just beginning. Oh, there's so much more to do. It reminds me of the story of Walter, of the little old woman's group that called on Winston Churchill after the end, the last days of World War II. And the little lady came in, the spokesman in tennis shoes, and said, Mr. Prime Minister, we want to talk about your drinking habits. We understand that if all the brandy that you've consumed during World War II were poured in this room, it would come up to about here, about half the room. And the Prime Minister looked at the floor and then looked at the ceiling and cast his eyes over about where they'd drawn the line on where the brandy would reach on the wall, and he said, my dear little lady, so little have I done, so much we have yet to do. So as I look back over the developments since President Kennedy sat in the garden in Palm Beach on December the 20th, 1960, some 9 years ago, I realize so little have we done, so much we have yet to do. And I think once the American people understand the benefits that have flowed from that indirectly, and it takes another decade before we really realize what benefits have come, before we're able to utilize them and develop them and to get the maximum benefit from them. We've got 11 million people, more people working today than working in 1960. Maybe half of it's due to the space effort, maybe a third. But we don't know yet that all this knowledge that we have acquired from this expenditure in space, what it will produce. But when we're able to develop it and apply it, I think we're going to be mighty happy.
What's happened to the Russians? Is it possible that we never did have a race to the moon, that we were just deluding ourselves, perhaps advantageously from a propaganda, internal propaganda standpoint, to sell the program? But where did they drop out?
I don't think that we know everything about what's happened to them. I don't think there's any question about what they've had a very serious interest, and they still have, in space. My best judgment is that they do not have the system of government that we have. And as a consequence, they don't have the freedom of decision that we have. And as a result, they can't get to the action that we got into our program. And I'm not one to say that they're not making great headway. I know they haven't ceased their efforts, but I learned at Glassboro and a good many other times when I had dealings with the Russians that they don't have the freedom to decide that the American president does, and the American Congress does. And I think the great strength of this program has been its openness. That you could go there and from the time of possible disaster, from the blast off until the splash down, everything they've done has been open to your eyes and your camera, and you've related it not just to the American people, but to all the world. And I think the decision that the government made and those of you in communication position contributed to has given this nation great strength and great admiration in the eyes of the rest of the world, that we could have our fires in public, we could have our disasters known, we could have our failures spread out on the pages of the congressional record, but they've been free to do it, and everything in the space effort has been an open program, open to the eyes of the world. And that's our system. And that's why we have a better system.
Of course, we don't have the Apollo 11 astronauts back yet. There's still plenty of danger points, potential for disaster in this flight. I gather from what you say that if anything untoward should happen now, we'll just have to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps and drive on to Apollo 12 and 13 and the rest of the mission.
Yes, I've ridden on every mission. I have had the concern that I think every American's had. I've watched with great eagerness and pride their every movement. And my prayers have followed them, and they will on this mission and the many other missions that must come. And I wish the cynics could spend a little time with the astronauts, because I think they represent most of America. I think there are very few people that think we're going to the dogs and that we've had it and everything we've done has been a mistake. We haven't done near enough. That's our problem. We have a lot of problems that haven't been solved. We haven't faced up to them. Just as we didn't face up to space in the 50s, we didn't face up to a lot of other things. We haven't faced up to the population problem. We haven't faced up to the food problem. Pretty soon we're going to have more people in the world than we can feed. We haven't faced up the problem that we're just a small little fly speck here on a great big world. There are 3 billion people in this world, and we just got 200 million. And we've got to find some way that all of us can live together without fighting and without killing and without destroying. We've got to find a way where we can eat and where we can educate our children and where we can have healthy bodies. And we are improving the life expectancy. We are bringing better health to the rest of the world. We are, but the Earth Resources satellite that's in the offing here has hopes of looking down on a great country like India with a population of several hundred million, 600 million people, and saying, here, you've had to get all this wheat, $1 billion worth of wheat from the United States to keep your people from starving to death. But the reason you had to is because you had a drought. Now, right over here, according to what we've learned from the Earth Resources satellite, you can get the water that's necessary to grow that wheat. As I said earlier, this is a beginning, but by no means is it an end. And if we are able to go to the moon, we can do anything needs to be done. I just hope that we go there and come back successfully. And then when we do, I hope it don't get complacent. I hope it'll just challenge us to go on and do these other things that need to be done. I think our people got to be patient. Some of them are not patient. Some of the older ones are not patient with the younger ones, and some of the younger ones are not patient with anyone. But they don't represent the majority at all. And what we've done in this field, we must do in other fields. And as Mr. Churchill said, so little have we done, so much we have yet to do.
Thank you, Mr. President.
That was Columbia Broadcasting System newsman Walter Cronkite speaking with former President Lyndon Johnson. We want to remind our listeners who are listening to us in Europe on the 251 meters medium wave band that they should now switch to 379 meters medium wave for more of our program, the special coverage of Apollo 11. In West Africa, listeners who are hearing us on 6035 should now switch to 7195. Well, the two men who last night took a giant step into the unknown, they're up and awake at this hour and preparing for the critical blastoff from the lunar surface and the long journey home. Firing of the ascent engine is scheduled in about 25 minutes. The Voice of America is standing by because right now, or very shortly, we'll be starting our special coverage of this part of the Apollo mission. This is Larry West in Washington. This program is originating in Washington, D.C.
This is the Voice of America, broadcasting throughout the world with continuing coverage of Apollo 11, man's first landing and walk on the moon. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Edwin Buzz Aldrin have been on the lunar surface for 21 hours and 13 minutes since their touchdown on Sunday at approximately 20 hours 17 Greenwich Mean Time. A few hours later, at 2 hours 56 GMT, Neil Armstrong became the first man to step onto the surface of the moon, saying, "That's one small step for man, one giant step for mankind." During their approximately 2 hours and 30 minutes on the lunar surface, Armstrong and Aldrin walked, or rather leaped and bounced easily, talking as they performed their numerous tasks, setting up an American flag, picking up rock samples, deploying scientific experiments, and reporting back to a TV audience of many millions all over the world just what they were seeing and doing. Now, another critical phase in this moon journey, as the astronauts prepare to fire their ascent engine in about 25 minutes from now, to leave the moon's surface to rendezvous with the mother spacecraft, Columbia, some 3.5 hours later, thus converting the temporary moon station, Tranquility Base, back into a space vehicle. We are reporting from the Voice of America's Apollo News Center in Washington, the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, and finally, Tranquility Base on the moon. Perhaps at this point I should re-identify my colleagues who will join us for this important phase of the Apollo 11 mission. I am William McCrory at the anchor desk, my VOA colleague Norman Guerin, at the Manned Spacecraft Center correspondent Rhett Turner. Our guest experts from NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, William Land, Apollo Missions Engineer, and John Hammersmith, Senior Systems Engineer. Now for a status report on preparations for the firing of the Eagle's ascent engine. Let's call in correspondent Rhett Turner at Mission Control in Houston.
22 minutes from now, we will be watching that ascent propulsion system begin to burn. It's about a 7-minute burn to lift the spacecraft, the upper portion of the lunar module, Eagle, up off the surface of the moon and into lunar orbit. Just 1 minute ago, we had communication with Mike Collins in Columbia as he is passing overhead. He should be very near to the overhead position above the lunar module within the next moment or two. And the actual liftoff time, down to the second, is calculated according to the position of Columbia in order to effect a rendezvous some hours from now. We have heard nothing at all in the last few minutes, no communication from Eagle, from Armstrong and Aldrin. They're going about their duties inside the spacecraft without communicating to Earth.
Here's a call. I'll give you a mark at 20 minutes to go, and that's in about 20 seconds.
This is the 20-minute to go mark coming up in about 15 seconds from now. That's Mission Control, the capsule communicator, talking to both Columbia and Tranquility Base, as he is calling them on radio.
Stand by. Mark, 20 minutes.
20 minutes until liftoff. We can see a countdown clock on that. Counting down to time of ignition of the ascent propulsion system engine. Now, this is the small engine, smaller than the descent engine, but the largest thing on the lunar module at the moment that can work. It has to fire. It has to lift them off. It is completely built with redundant systems, double valves, double piping, double controls, double fuel lines, and double igniters, as a matter of fact, one combustion chamber. The only thing that is not duplicated is the actual nozzle and combustion chamber. There are less than 100 moving parts, less than 100 moving parts in this ascent propulsion system engine, and there's great confidence in its reliability, but of course it has to work in order to lift Eagle back up into space into orbit around the moon for rendezvous and docking with the mothership, Columbia, and that return to Earth. That's the status as of the moment, Bill.
The Voice of America's continuing coverage of the Apollo 11 mission. In about 20 minutes from now, the firing of that ascent engine.
And when the Eagle's ascent engine fires for about 7 minutes and 14 seconds, it will have a thrust of about 3,500 pounds or 1,600 kilograms. This powered ascent will be in about two stages. First, the vertical ascent of about 10 seconds in order to clear the terrain. And then the orbital insertion phase, when the Eagle pitches over as it reaches a height of about 250 feet. At that point, the lunar craft will be placed in an orbit of 9 by 45 nautical miles. This would come about at about 166 nautical miles west of the landing site in the Sea of Tranquility. After coasting in this orbit, this low orbit, for about an hour, the RCS thrusters, these are the small thrusters on the lunar module, will be fired again to begin what we call CSI, the concentric sequence initiation, changing to a near circular orbit of 45.5 by 44.2 nautical miles, bringing the Eagle ever closer to the mother spacecraft Columbia. After another hour of coasting in this orbit, we come to the TPI, the terminal phase initiation, changing the Eagle's orbit once again to about 61.2 by 43.2 nautical miles, still catching up with Columbia. After the TPI maneuver and the coast period, the Eagle should be within a range of about 2 kilometers from Columbia. Then we have about 4 braking maneuvers if they are necessary, if they are needed, closing in for rendezvous and docking about 3.5 hours from the liftoff from the surface of the moon. That time on the surface of the moon for Tranquility Base, which will soon become again a lunar vehicle, 21 hours and 20 minutes. During this period that we'll be preparing for the ascent, and of course during the rendezvous, Mike Collins, who is alone up in the command module Columbia, will be a very busy person. A few days before the flight, correspondent Rhett Turner talked with Mike Collins about his job as command module pilot, especially during this critical rendezvous period of the lunar ship with the command craft.
Mike, you'll be one man in a three-man command craft during parts of the flight, the most important part, the crucial return to the mother ship. You're going to be rather busy, aren't you?
Yes and no. I hope I'll be very unbusy. I have two roles to play. First, I act as the passive target vehicle, and in the event that everything is working perfectly within the LEM, then I am not unduly busy. I have many chores to do, and I prepare to take an active role in bringing the two vehicles together. However, as I say, provided the LEM works and can, its radar is working properly and it's capable of making each and every maneuver leading up to the rendezvous and docking, then my job is essentially a quiescent one. On the other hand, should difficulties arise within the LEM, then my job is to rescue the LEM, and I then find myself becoming the active partner in charge of a very complex vehicle with a very complex job. And this is when I truly become busy, and I'm literally racing from one side of the cockpit to the other, getting solutions to various problems from my digital computer, making sure that my rendezvous radar transponder and VHF ranging systems are working properly, and doing a host of other small details, all of which are necessary for the successful completion of the rendezvous.
To what extent do you prepare mirror image rendezvous figures? Just during the descent, there is a point at which the lunar module is beyond your having reverse maneuvers prepared, isn't there?
Well, I, of course, once the lunar module is deep into its descent, then I am unable to do any sort of mirror image maneuver to bring the two vehicles together. There's a point of no return beyond which the LEM is, you might say, on its own. And in similar fashion, the LEM must be able to lift off from the lunar surface and be able to inject itself into a safe orbit. These things are necessary. I play no part in these portions of the mission. However, once the LEM has reached a safe orbit, then literally almost an infinite number of possibilities offer themselves. There are situations in which the LEM is ahead of the command module, others in which the command module is ahead of the LEM. There are some cases, orbital mechanics are peculiar things. They say that the higher you go, the slower you go, the lower, the faster. So we take advantage of this fact in our attempt to bring the two vehicles together. And the vehicle ahead normally goes high and slows down, while the vehicle trailing goes low and therefore catches up. This strategy prevails for a certain combination of vehicle relative positions, beyond which we find that, for example, if the LEM is trailing, then it can no longer catch the command module, and now we want to bring the command module around and catch the LEM. So we reverse our strategy, send the command module low, raise the LEM high. At first, as I say, this appears to be almost a bewildering number of possibilities, but they do they boil down to several categories of general situations, and we approach them that way.
You are in the spacecraft, though, that has the almost infinite possibilities, and you are the one who's had to train on this great number of possibilities for rescue. Don't you feel somewhat overwhelmed sometimes with the
amount of paperwork? Well, I would, were it not for the fact that I get a great measure of help from the ground. The Mission Control Center is staffed by a great number of people, each of whom is an expert in some particular part of the mission, and the Rendezvous side of the house is very adequately staffed with experts, and I mean really true experts, people who have devoted a major portion of their lives for the last, I don't know, half a dozen years at least to solving these problems, and I have the utmost confidence in their ability to help me, and otherwise I would in fact feel overwhelmed by the possibilities.
If you've got communications, you have help.
That's true, and of course there's always a possibility that we can lose communications, and these are the games that we play in our training. We say, well, suppose the LEM found itself in this strange orbit, and then suppose we lost communications, and then suppose the other bad thing happened, and we pile one little catastrophe on top of the other and try to see whether we can extricate ourselves from the difficulty which we've pretended we're in. And this is why training for us is so complicated and time-consuming. The normal flow of events in the mission are relatively simple. There are many places in which we have the capability to make some dreadful error which is going to cause the mission to be lost, but in general the main flow of normal events is fairly straightforward. It's only when you get into suppose this breaks and suppose that breaks and suppose the other breaks that you really find yourself faced with these incredibly complicated situations.
Is there any particular facet of rendezvous, docking, or rescue which you feel is more exciting or important than another? What stands out foremost?
Well, I don't know. I'll have to look back on it and tell you what was most exciting.
What do you feel that you have to concentrate most on, or is most crucial then? You must have learned some of this.
Well, unfortunately, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link, and we don't want any one link to be obviously weak. So if we spot one, this seems like a soft spot or a weak link, well, then we drop what we're doing and focus our attention on it for a while. So hopefully each and every sequence along the way has been practiced and rehearsed and worked out to the point that we clearly understand it, and it's no longer a weak link. So I hope that I'm unable to answer your question now, and I hope that I'll still be unable to after the flight. I want this chain to be all strong links with no weak ones.
Thanks very much, Mike Collins.
A very thorough description of the events of rendezvous that will come about immediately after liftoff from Mike Collins, who's been up there alone now for some 21 hours and 28 minutes, while his colleagues, Neil Armstrong and Edwin Aldrin, have been on the surface of the moon. While that interview was being played back from Apollo Mission Control, we heard a go for liftoff for the lunar spacecraft Eagle. Let's get a further report now from the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston, correspondent Rhett Turner.
We're listening to the Mission Control Center as it is instructing Eagle on the things it should do to lift off. We know that this ascent propulsion system engine must fire for over 7 minutes, between 7:14 and 7:18 in order to impart a velocity up into orbit of 6,600 kilometers per hour, about 6,649, as a matter of fact, according to the announcement from Mission Control. This very reliable ascent propulsion system engine exerts 3,500 pounds of thrust in a vacuum, and it's there in the moon on a vacuum. It is not throttleable like the descent engine is. In other words, it cannot hover. It can just go and go full blast. And that's why it's designed with utter simplicity, the most reliable parts available, complete redundancy or duplication of all parts in the engine. And at the moment, the command module, the lunar module. That was Mike Collins who said, Neil, I'm reading you real good. They're communicating to each other.
Couldn't be better. It's just burn lock.
Mike Collins says he reads Neil very good. It couldn't be better. Occasionally you will hear Mission Control cut in with some bit of information. Of course, telemetry and tracking data is continuing to come back to Earth from both spacecraft, the large tracking antennas around the world, in Australia and Spain and here in the United States, locked in to give the greatest assistance possible to the three astronauts. Not very much at this moment. We have heard very little communication, only quick and succinct remarks when something needed to be imparted between the two, when some communication was necessary. In the Mission Control Center, all the men are sitting at their consoles, watching carefully, in fairly relaxed form.
We're only about 7 minutes away now from liftoff.
52 minutes before the command module goes around behind the moon, out of sight. By then, the lunar module should be well on its way and into an orbit in which they can effect a rendezvous. 5:45 now until ignition of the ascent propulsion system engine.
I believe this is the first time, of course, that the ascent engine has been fired using the descent stage as a launching platform.
That's called fire in the hole. They've never had to do that before. That's right.
Would you explain that a bit further, Rhett, the firing in the hole? That is firing through the lower stage.
Yeah, the ascent stage engine projects down into the descent stage of the lunar module, right on top of that descent engine. Each of these two main rockets are mounted on the in the very center of the mass, of the weight structure of the lunar module. Therefore, in order to fire along the center of gravity of the spacecraft mass, they had to be mounted in line. So with the descent stage used as a launching platform now, the upper portion of the limb, the ascent stage,
that's 25. At translation, 4 jet.
That's Aldrin.
Balance couple on. DTCA jet.
Going through checklist.
Stop, push button, reset.
Push button reset, PTC set.
4 minutes and 30 seconds until launch.
Dead band minimum. At control, mode control.
Buzz Aldrin control, reading out his checklist auto. To Neil Armstrong.
Crew of Eagle going through their pre-ignition checklist.
Prepare standing by for 2 minutes to put the guidance steering in the ag.
Guidance steering in the AGS, the AGS, the abort guidance system.
We understand that they may turn on the television camera just before launch. Of course, it would be clipped off the moment separation came.
Well, we're waiting to see a display of that sort. It has not appeared yet. I hope so, too. Countdown, 3:45 until ignition.
Eagle Houston, you're looking good to us.
That, I believe, is either Owen Garriott or Bruce McCandless there. as the capsule communicator, a fellow astronaut.
Guidance computer aboard the LIM, or aboard Eagle, will be loaded with the program 12, powered ascent guidance. We'll continue to monitor now at 3 minutes 12 seconds away from ignition as crew of Eagle goes through their pre-launch checklist.
As you have undoubtedly heard, if you've been following this event with us from its beginning, there are any number of these P-dash numbers, program number so-and-so, to go into the computer or to be read out from the computer in guiding an activity automatically.
Is there...
Program 12 for powered ascent guidance.
Is there manual control during any phase of this ascent?
I think this is all automatic. He could take over if he had to by instantly grabbing the hand controller. One quick comment there from Buzz Aldrin, not quite legible. 2 minutes and 15 seconds now until ignition.
Well, we do know that the surface, the lunar surface, is quite hard, so that there shouldn't be too much of a problem as it lifts off.
Coming up on 2 minutes. Mark, minus two minutes.
Roger, guidance bearing in the ag.
Minute and 50 seconds now until liftoff. Another comment there from Buzz Aldrin about the condition of the ags, the abort guidance system. This is the secondary gyro system, the pings and the ags, the primary guidance navigation control system, PGNCS, and the abort guidance system, AGS, or ags. Minute and 25 seconds now until that engine is scheduled to blast off. We do not see a television transmission yet. If it is to be projected back to Earth, of course, the TV would stop the instant that the ascent stage cut its umbilicals with the descent stage and the rocket fired. This is almost in split-second timing.
Retro arm on,
says Buzz Aldrin. Or arm, something armed. I may have missed the word retro. 49 seconds. 45. Until ignition, 3,500 pounds of thrust all the way for 7 minutes and 14 to 18 seconds to put the lunar module up into orbit.
Reports both navigation systems on Eagle are looking good.
Both the pings and the eggs looking good. 25 seconds. That static coming from the command module. Up above listening. 13 seconds, 10 seconds till ignition.
9, 8, 7, 6, 5, white stage, engine arm ascent, proceed.
Should have liftoff.
26, 36 feet per second up.
We're moving.
Pitch over.
Pitching over.
Very smooth.
Very smooth, says Buzz Aldrin.
Balance couple off.
Balance couple off, I believe, is that comment?
Very quiet ride.
Very quiet ride. They're standing up inside the lunar module. It's lifting off the surface of the moon.
1,000 feet high, 80 feet per second vertical rise.
About 300 meters off the surface now. Beginning to pitch over.
Request manual start override.
Beginning to pitch over to the west. This burn should last
2,600 feet altitude.
Some 700 meters now. 700 to 800 meters high. Picking up speed. The little engine that has to work.
You go, Houston, 1 minute, you're looking good.
1 minute, you're looking good, says Houston. Confirmation, Roger, coming back from either Armstrong or Aldrin.
130 feet. Vertical rise rate.
A little bit of slow wallowing back and forth.
A little bit of slow wallowing back and forth.
Activity.
Some thruster activity. The attitude
Roger,
thruster.
Fine.
Lunar module now continuing to thrust.
150 up. Beautiful.
150.
9,000.
9,000 feet. Some 3,000 meters now.
AAG degrees within a foot per second.
Moving, I think he said 150 feet per second.
Eagle Houston, you're looking good at 2. Pings, AGs, and Mistin, all agree.
Pings, AGs, primary and backup guidance systems, looking good.
Coming out beautiful, 14,000.
14,000 feet.
And a foot per second again, AGs to pings.
A foot per second, AGs to pings. Buzz Aldrin calling out these readings back to Earth.
Roger, we great. 1600, 185.
Aldrin is reading the horizontal velocity first, and then the vertical velocity. It's now 1424 feet per second vertical velocity, 187 vertical velocity.
In other words,
Eagle Houston, your go at 3 minutes. Everything's looking good.
I think Terry got that turned around there. They're moving horizontally faster than they're moving vertically. They're moving up about 185 feet per second and horizontally some 1,400 feet per second, some 400 to 500 meters per second horizontally.
This is H-Dot Max now.
3 minutes into this burn, 4 minutes to go. These are velocity readings that you hear Buzz Aldrin calling out.
Write down US-1.
Write down US-1, says Neil Armstrong, referring to one of the rills, a very prominent feature out west of the Sea of Tranquility in the takeoff zone.
Now approaching 32,000 feet.
Some 10,000 meters now, up about 10 kilometers above the surface. Continuing to thrust this 3,500-pound
Eagle Houston, 4 minutes. You're going right down the track. Everything's great.
Houston says you're going right down the track.
Horizontal velocity approaching 2,500 feet per second.
That's the beam off to our right now.
You hear two. You hear two components: horizontal velocity
some
and.
Some 120 miles to go until insertion.
About another 200 plus kilometers to go until insertion into orbit.
We're ready to go.
Continuing to thrust, that engine working just as it's supposed to do. Those hypergolic fuels, the fuels which ignite upon contact, flowing into that single thrust chamber through one great injector system.
Schmidt,
the crater Schmidt.
That's impressive. Look at it.
They're calling off some of the
landmarks.
You're
great. 155.
Right down the track, they've just passed over Sabine and Ritter.
All three data sources are agreeing quite closely here. The three-color plot board on the front of mission control here is almost superimposed as each of the three colors are scribed on the scribing plotter.
They should be passing over the crater Dionysius, 18 degrees east, about now, continuing to thrust up into the sky, up into the space. We may hear them mention some more crater names. Theon Senior, Theon Senior A, Dionysius. This crater, Schmidt, located.
Eagle Houston, you're still looking mighty fine.
Still looking good, continuing to thrust. 6 minutes, another minute.
Roger, good agreement in Delta V to go in both AGs and pings. Roger.
The AGs and the pings agree in the readings they're giving for guidance throughout this burn. This is, of course, critical. During all of this...
1 minute to go in the burn.
During this expending of great amounts of energy,
4,482 feet per second horizontal velocity.
During